Hi, it's Marcus here, and this week marks the 52nd episode and the one-year anniversary of Recruiting Trailblazers. So, for my anniversary, I thought that I would invite back a couple of guests that I've really enjoyed speaking to, and one of whom is Vanessa Rath, who is the global sourcing trainer based in South Africa. Love her. She's fantastic. If you ever need sourcing training, she's the person to talk to. And the other one is James Hornick, who is a partner at Hirewell in Chicago, which is a 70-person recruiting agency. And we had a really good chat when he came on the podcast recently. And he's the fellow who publishes that excellent newsletter called Talent Rants and Sarcasm. So it's about a 20-minute chat with each, just catching up on a few things, getting a few tips and tricks and observations on what's happening in the market at the moment. So I hope you enjoy this one. And if we're not connected on LinkedIn, please send me a connection request and let's have a chat sometime. Okay, here it is, the anniversary of Recruiting Trailblazers. Cheers. Coming to you from Silicon Valley, I'm Marcus Edwards, and I'm on the hunt for recruiting leaders, producers, innovators, and pioneers who've made their mark on the industry and can't wait to share their points of view. We'll tackle the tough topics and dig deep to find the answers you're looking for and some actionable advice you can take to the bank. So stick around and stay tuned, and welcome to Recruiting Trailblazers. So I'm very excited to welcome back to the podcast Vanessa Rath. Vanessa is a global talent sourcing trainer and an international keynote speaker, and she is based in South Africa, and she is my go-to person for all things sourcing. So welcome back to Recruiting Trailblazers, Vanessa Rath. How are you?
Awesome. Thanks for having me back, Marcus. I must say, since we last chatted, there's been lots of people who contacted me saying, hey, I heard you on Recruiting Trailblazers, and it's really great. So thank you, and thank you for having me back. This is great.
Yeah, I had great feedback on the episode I did with you, so fantastic.
Good.
So let's get straight into this, Vanessa. This is a bit of a catch-up podcast we're having here right now. You know, market conditions have changed dramatically since we last spoke, which was sort of, you know, in the middle of the pandemic. How hard has the sourcing role now become over the last 6 months? And is it getting harder?
So it's actually quite interesting that you say this, because I want to touch on two things when I answer this. Is yes, it's definitely got more difficult, to be honest. But what's so interesting to see, and what I want to start with, is that how the demand for sourcers and recruiters from a global perspective has literally gone through the roof. I mean, I'm contacted every single day by clients all over the world saying, hey, I need a good recruiter, or I need a good sourcer. Do you know anyone? And I just think that people are realizing the value that having a good sourcer or recruiter on your team actually gives to the business. And I think it's amazing, because finally, us in this profession, who've often been like treated as the ugly redheaded stepchild of the HR department, are now getting the kudos that we deserve. And the good ones are standing out. So I think that in itself is amazing. I don't know if you're seeing the same thing in the States.
Absolutely. The same thing is happening over here right now. And by the good ones, I assume you mean the ones that have been trained by you.
Well, I mean, I don't want to be biased and just come out and say that on a podcast, yeah. You know, but I'd like to think so.
Yeah, I know. I'm just kidding. But yeah, the same thing's been happening here. And it feels like whiplash.
Yeah.
Because this time last year, there were a lot of recruiters and sourcers that were being laid off.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that everyone has found their way back to work, and that demand is even higher than it was pre-pandemic. So yeah.
Absolutely.
Definitely a case of whiplash. There's tremendous demand around the world. And obviously, things have got a little bit more interesting because there's a lot more remote opportunities now than there ever has
Absolutely.
Been before. Are you seeing that too? Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I'm seeing international companies targeting, you know, South African recruiters and sourcers and bringing them onto their international teams. And, you know, South Africans are perfectly situated for a European time zone. So I can understand why it's happening. But I mean, from a training perspective, I'm super busy. I mean, I'm literally booked into September, which is phenomenal. Like, I keep having to pinch myself. But what I'm hearing out there from the marketplace is why sourcing has become so difficult is that it's not actually more difficult to find the people. But what is more difficult is the key to get people to leave jobs. So it's that passive talent that are sitting, you know, quite happily in a position. They're happy there. The company looked after them during COVID. They're on a good wicket. They're 100% remote. you know, it's more difficult to get them to leave organizations because everyone's so scared of this third wave, this fourth wave, you know, whatever's coming our way. And they don't want to be, you know, join a company and then leave on a LIFO situation, last in, first out. So I think we can still find the candidates, but that whole persuasion piece is becoming more and more critical and more difficult.
Yeah. I mean, do you suspect that it might become easier? Have you heard about this impending great resignation where people weren't considering a job change during the pandemic, but as pandemic restrictions ease and companies call employees back to the office, then people might start resigning, especially if they're looking for fully remote roles, if their company wants them to come back full time to the office?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, basically what I'm hearing from the marketplace, from the candidate side at the moment, is that I loved working from home. I could spend time and, you know, with my family. I was far more productive. I wasn't wasting 2 hours every day in the commute. And now I need to be back in the office every Monday and Friday, and sometimes honest, every second Wednesday. And it's just not going to work for me. So I think that, you know, you hear different stories from clients. They want to see their people. They want to have them in the office. So I can understand both sides of the coin here. But I really think that we're not going to have a one size fits all in this situation, is that you're going to have to listen to what your skilled employees are looking for, what works for them, and try and work around that. Because doing a blanket, everyone back in the office, you know, Monday to Friday, I don't believe that that's going to work anymore. Because the most people that I'm getting contacting me looking for something new is because there's just been a big drive into let's go back to the office. And a lot of people don't want that.
And I think that's where the opportunity is going to be created, are the companies who force the hybrid model and say you've got to come back at least 3 times a week or even 5 days a week. And then those people will be targeted by recruiters, because there'll be a high percentage of people who would like to just carry on working fully remotely. Or if they don't want to carry on working fully remotely, they want the option of going into the office. So instead of a forced hybrid model, then an optional hybrid model to say, listen, the office is here if you need to. It'd be lovely to see you a couple of times a week, 2 or 3 times a week if you fancy it. I think that's a model that could work, as opposed to this forced hybrid model, which I think will backfire in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're never going to go back to what we were pre-COVID. And I don't think that we're all going to look the same post-COVID. And I think that companies, you need to kind of, you know, forge their own way, find what works for them and go with it, because it really is going to come down to each individual and what the company's needs are. So it's going to be super interesting from here on out.
Yeah. So you're saying, look, you can still find the people. Good sources can still identify the candidates in the marketplace. But the tricky part, and where sources need to adapt their strategy, is how they go about representing the brand or the company that they're looking to recruit for.
Yes.
And that's perhaps where the opportunity is. So how do we achieve that?
So for me, there's a very simple answer to this. It's all about the recruiter or the sourcer, if the sourcer is reaching out to the candidates, online brand themselves. Because they need to look like a recruiter who's worth talking to. You know, there's a lot of recruiters and sources out there who don't spend time on their online brand, don't try and, you know, boost the recommendations on their LinkedIn profiles, you know, still say that they're working in a different company on Facebook to where they're working on LinkedIn. And those are the recruiters who are going to be dead in the water soon, because they don't realize is that when they get when the candidate gets an email from them, they're going to be cross-referenced on whatever is the favorite platform or platforms of the candidate. And if you're not conscious of your online brand, you know, what you're putting out there, you know, is everything consistent, then we're going to be having a problem here, because already the trust is lost. So for me, the recruiters and sources who have spent a long time building up bigger networks, you know, share a lot on the social platforms, give back to people, are the ones who are going to be contacted first. Because, you know, the old saying, top of mind, tip of tongue. And those are the recruiters and the sources who are immediately going to be known to these individuals who want to move, and they're going to want to work with them. But a recruiter who's an unknown with no online presence or digital footprint or anything like that is really going to have difficulty in trying to persuade candidates to work with them.
Okay, so recognition is key. And we've been talking about this on the podcast for the last year about how you need to build your brand. So ultimately, when you reach out to candidates, they kind of already know who you are because you've been connected for a while. And it doesn't come as a surprise to them when they see your name and a possible opportunity. And then they feel more comfortable getting back to you. So the online brand has become very, very important indeed, hasn't it?
a very powerful tool that, you know what, you're in charge of it. You can control, you can put out the information that you want. And that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of your online brand, is it all comes down to you and how hard you want to work at it. But remember, I always say you want to be phone call number two. So as soon as that candidate makes a decision, that's it, I'm out of here. The company's just announced I need to be, you know, traveling to New York, but I live in LA and that's not going to work for me anymore. Then they're going to phone their partner and say, I'm out of here. And you're going to be the second phone call. They're going to phone you and say, hey, I want to work with you. You are the go-to recruiter in my space. You stand out as the recruiter with the most experience in tech or FMCG or legal or whatever it might be. Let's work together.
Right. So you're talking about inbound here. So you've got to have such a strong brand that you are the second phone call after the family. That's a good one.
Yeah.
For them to call and say, hey, yeah, I've decided I'm going to be moving on. So that's very good. But when you're being proactive, and which most of us are, let's be honest, most of the work we do is very proactive in reaching out, yes, to candidates and, you know, building relationships with those candidates. What do we need to do a little bit better? Is it about the brand that we're working for? Is it harder now for internal recruiters or agency recruiters to find the same candidate and convince the same candidate? And what about brand recognition? If we're not representing brands that are recognized, is it much harder as a source or a recruiter to get a response from candidates?
Absolutely. So, you know, all of the things that you've mentioned there are the same. They were exactly the same pre-COVID. You know, would someone rather work for Google or do they rather work for a three-person startup? You know, it's a lot easier to sell the bigger brands. That hasn't changed. You know, also from an agency perspective, you know, you mentioned there, would people rather deal with a company than an agency? Well, it depends. You know, if the agency recruiter is really good and they really understand their clients and can sell it, they could probably get by. But if it's an agency recruiter who's working with 35 different clients and doesn't know them and can't really sell them that well, then no, it's not going to work. And I don't think that any of these things have changed since before COVID, you know. I was chatting to a client today and they were saying that he reached out to someone directly as a co-founder of the business and he got a response straight away. I mean, I've been after the same candidate for 3 months as an external resource. It's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah. Do you think recruiters and sources are following up enough? I mean, how many messages is it taking you and the people that you're training to get through to the candidates that you want to talk to? It's definitely not just one message, is it?
Oh, definitely not. No, I'm working on between 4 and 5. And I mean, people work on different numbers. It depends on the role. It depends on who I'm sourcing for. But, you know, 4 or 5 for me is pretty much the average. But I know people that go up to 7 outreach messages to candidates. So it's another thing that we need to be considering is that, you know, we need to get these things automated because that's also going to take a lot of time. It will save us a lot of time if we have some automation in place. You know, when it comes to sourcing, a lot of people say, where do you find the time? You know, and I'm so busy, but are we busy on the right activities? You know, I'm still hearing a lot of sources, recruiters are posting ads, spraying and praying, going through mountains of useless ad response. Meanwhile, they should be more laser focused on going after passive talent and finding the best people that way, because it's a much, much more effective exercise.
And obviously here in the US, I know it's slightly different in South Africa, but here in the US, there's a huge sort of reliance upon LinkedIn Recruiter.
Oh, yeah.
And LinkedIn Recruiter isn't the easiest platform to follow up on. I mean, it offers you the chance to send an in-mail. And of course, you can send another one, but then recruiters are reluctant to burn all their in-mails on the same people.
Yeah.
So what are you recommending in South Africa? Because I know when you train, you're not just training people how to use LinkedIn Recruiter. You're training people how to search outside of LinkedIn Recruiter.
Absolutely.
And do X-ray searching and use automation tools and use email, etc. So what are some of your recommendations outside of LinkedIn Recruiter for people to be, you know, finding and following up with the right candidates?
So it was actually quite interesting. I was trading a company this morning who relies so heavily on LinkedIn Recruiter. I was actually quite amazed. And they're a South African company. So, you know, I think that the dependence is there regardless where we are globally. But, you know, for me, it's about being more creative than just looking on LinkedIn for candidates. You know, why are we looking on LinkedIn only when Facebook has got so many people on their platform? I mean, we're talking like 10 times or even more people on Facebook than there are in LinkedIn. So for me, that's right. My training's all about, you know, if you're looking for tech people, don't be wasting your time on LinkedIn. Get over to GitHub and Stack Overflow and, you know, find out more about them there and then reach out to them via email. There is life after LinkedIn. believe it or not. And I do believe that there are different, there are better tools and platforms for email automation. Like you and I have chatted about Sourcewell a couple of times, and that's my go-to for automating email outreach campaigns. And it really does save me a lot of time. So I'm kind of using the tech to save me time so that it frees my time up to actually just spend more time with people. And I think that that's the important part these days.
Yeah. How easy is it to find good technical talent on places like Stack Overflow and GitHub, and indeed on Facebook as well?
So for me, it's you've just got to learn how to use them. I mean, all of these sites have different nuances. You've just got to know what those nuances are. It's not difficult. It's just all about learning a new skill. And I think that that's exciting because there's a lot of recruiters out there who are like, I can't go and spend another day trolling through job boards and LinkedIn. This is boring. I need to do something else. And when I do the training with them, it's so awesome. I mean, I love to see that light bulb moment, as I call it, where they realize there's life after LinkedIn, and pretty much they need to be focusing on other ways of finding candidates that no one else is finding. Because as an agency, you don't want to be putting the same candidates in front of the client because everyone's just taking the same candidates off LinkedIn. I mean, that's not going to win you any business at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah. LinkedIn's a big platform. So there's definitely a lot of crossover. We're all going after the same candidates.
For sure. Java developers.
Yeah. Can you imagine how many in-mails Java developers get on a daily basis?
Yeah, I would say anywhere upwards of 25, 30, 35.
Yeah.
Yeah. Easy. Yeah.
And at that point, it's really hard to differentiate yourself as a recruiter, even if you're personalizing your message to a high degree. And what are your recommendations around personalization these days? I know we're getting through a lot of information here quickly, but what do you think about personalization right now?
Yeah, it's top. It's key. It really and truly is. I mean, the days of the templates, in my opinion, are gone. It's about all about the candidate. It's been like that for a long time, but even more. I mean, I was reading an article recently, and they were saying that personalization goes much further than putting the candidate's name into the body of the email when you're addressing it. It's in the first paragraph, you need to mention where they work, you know, what projects have they worked on, what qualifications and certifications have they got that you're after. So yeah, it's a lot more in depth than just, you know, calling someone by the right name, which is a step in the right direction too for some recruiters.
It is, but it takes so much time to do that. I mean, a lot of recruiters, I think, are on the fence. I'm not. I've always thought personalization is the big differentiator. But the problem with very detailed personalization is that, you know, it costs you 5 minutes per outreach, per single outreach, whether it's in LinkedIn Recruiter or an email. And so it really limits the amount of messages you can get out on a daily basis, right?
But if you are sending more targeted messages to more targeted individuals, you might only have to reach out to 10 as opposed to trying to reach 500 by sending a template. So it's a trade-off.
I completely agree. When I see a template land in my inbox, whether it's my email or my LinkedIn Recruiter inbox, you can see it coming a mile away, can't you? Because there's no personalization. And so therefore, you know, it's not really meant for you. It's probably meant for somebody else. Yeah. And so I don't respond to those at all. I just immediately hit delete. But somebody who's taken the time, obviously, to understand who I am or mention the podcast or something, I'll always get back to them. And so that's definitely the protocol for me when I'm reaching out to candidates.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that it's not a choice anymore, is it? You know, we're going to do it, and we're going to be a good recruiter, and we're going to get good response rates. And that's what it's all about. You know, we don't want to be wasting time with templates.
And you can also segment your candidates into different sort of domains and geographies and companies and automate personalization to a certain extent, can't
Absolutely.
You?
Yeah. You can completely. You can customize certain fields. You can leave something blank for a company name, which can be filled in at a later stage. Yeah, the tools are getting really advanced these days, which is great. You know, anything that saves us time and allows us to be more human is great.
So what's top of mind? This is a great little catch up. We've crammed a lot into a short space of time. What's top of mind right now when a recruiter or a sourcer reaches out to you and says, you know, I'm struggling right now to get the response that I used to? What's your number one piece of advice right now?
Oh, Marcus, that's very easy to answer is get some training, do some research. Because, you know, we can't, as recruiters and sourcers, keep doing things that we've been doing for the last 5, 10, 15 years and expect it to be working. The market's changed. Talent has changed. you know, COVID's accelerated all of this, but it was changing before COVID. And I think that if we're not keeping up to date with trends, we're literally going to be out with the dinosaurs. I mean, I've had someone on my training last week who's been a sourcer for 12 years. And she says, I didn't even know about these sites. And I said, well, how could you have been a sourcer? You know, it just amazes me how much people, you know, get by with a little training. And I don't blame the people because we don't know what we don't know. But you need to start investing in yourself to empower yourself to do better. And that for me can be done through training very easily.
Fantastic. And so we come full circle. How do people in the US get in touch with you? And can we actually go through one of your training programs?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I'm not hard to find. I'm not going to lie. You can track me down on LinkedIn. My website is vanessaroth.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. So yeah, whatever's your preferred platform, pop my name into a Google search and contact me with whatever works best for you. I'm happy to help.
Do you, by the way, have any online course offerings? Because the time difference can sometimes make live training very tricky between the US and South Africa.
Let's face it, being a global online trainer, I'm often up at 4 a.m. to train Australia side. I'm happy to be flexible. I think, you know, when you're running a business like I do and you enjoy the global flavor, as the trainer, you need to realize that you can just have to like rearrange your day, which is not a problem.
Absolutely. Completely understand that. Skate to where the puck's going to be.
Exactly.
Vanessa Rath, my good friend now. Global talent sourcing trainer. I really appreciate you coming back on the podcast for a quick chat.
Awesome.
We'll speak again very soon. Thanks again and have a great evening.
Thanks, Marcus. You're a star. Chat soon.
Okay. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay. So that was fun. Thanks, Vanessa. And so we're on to the second part of this week's anniversary edition of Recruiting Trailblazers with my short conversation with James Hornick of Hirewell in Chicago. Take it away, James. I'm excited again today to welcome back one of my favorite guests, James Hornick, who's a partner at Hirewell, which when I spoke with him last, it was a 60 plus person tech and marketing recruitment agency in Chicago. But we'll check in with James in a minute to see whether that's changed. He's a prolific 70.
Yeah.
He's a prolific content creator, publishes a great newsletter, which I subscribe to called Talent Rants and Sarcasm. Welcome back to the podcast, James Hornick. How are you, James?
Great. Now that I'm here, you know, First, thanks for having me, but this is clearly the highlight of my day. So,
oh, thank you, man. I really
appreciate it. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, look, one of the reasons I wanted to get you back on is because we only spoke fairly recently, but we had a great episode. And as you know, I'm a bit of a fan of your content and stuff. And you published some somewhat controversial, but always fun stuff about recruiting. You debunk myths, which we'll talk about today. And I just wanted to check in with you and see how growth is going for you. We're in a crazy market right now. It's very candidate driven. It's very hard to hire good recruiters. You know, what's going on with you and what are you guys doing right now to differentiate yourself in this marketplace where everybody seems to be going after the same candidates?
Well, we're having our best year ever. So it's unexpected. If you'd have told me that 6 months ago, I would have been absolutely shocked. You know, like at the end of last year, we saw things really growing. But I'm aghast at just how insanely runaway of a market this is. So yeah, we're up to 70 people. So we've made 15 hires this year, of recruiters. So
congratulations.
And I think that also answers your question though, on how you differentiate yourselves, because, it's, I guess if I'm going to back it up and kind of explain it, bandwidth, I never in a million years would have thought, I don't think I've ever seen a market where we were so maxed out from the sales side that the deliveries become harder, that we need more recruiters to grow, to deliver more. Like I want to chase down more sales, but like the recruiter market itself is so competitive right now. So to give you an example, technology is always where we started. We also do HR was a secondary we got into. We also do digital experience and marketing, finance, accounting, sales, all that. HR, so internal recruiters on any given year is usually our second most often or second largest filled position by volume. So it's software developers one, internal recruiters two. So now the funny thing is last year, you know, between April and September, I don't think we filled a single one. No one was hiring recruiters, period. There's great recruiters unemployed. Fast forward, it's like I think we've placed 15, I want to say 15 to 20 recruiters every month this year so far, and which we're well beyond pace for an all-time high, while also hiring 15 recruiters internally. And our business, like if we just had, if I would have hired 30 or 40 or 50, like we have that, there's that much going on where we're just hamstrung by not having enough people. So I think to getting to your point, what we've done differently is the fact that we've been able to hire the people that we have has been largely driven by our own messaging. So like our initially just, I think the content that we do differentiates us from other organizations because for various reasons, I mean, we try to talk about relevant topics. We also try to be candid so people get a sense for, okay, these guys are glued in or tied into what's happening in the industry. They know what's going on, but also, you know, they're very, I can tell they're, it's like talking to a regular person. That's resonated. So it's made it, it's come up in almost every conversation, not as like why people want to join us per se, but like it's, it made us stick out. So I can say definitively that the content aspect worked.
Is that mainly due to your sort of your talent rants and sarcasm and your YouTube channel and the fun stuff that you're doing? Because I mean, you do take this very seriously, but we'll get into a couple of your content pieces in a minute. Sure. But you always take a slightly different angle or perspective on problems and somewhat controversial as well, as I've said before. But it's extremely authentic and I connect with all of your content. I think it's excellent. So is that what's really resonating with people who want to come and join the firm?
Some of it, but really it's a team effort. I'm not the only one really kind of doing it. Like we've made a concerted effort to get every other week. We have a crew of people, whoever wants to do it, be on our committee where all we do, we brainstorm ideas. What are our clients talking about? What are candidates talking about? What are the most pressing issues out there? That way we've got, you know, a dozen or so people just trying to say, okay, here's what I've noticed in the past 2 weeks. Here's what people have been asking me. Here's where our clients are getting tripped up. So we actually have relevant topics to discuss. And then we just kind of spitball, okay, what should our take be? Because like, otherwise, you know, we're not trying to like come up with something that's controversial or something that's like against the grain. But I think that half the time our industry gets it wrong, to be honest, you know, so let's just take a minute to think about it and kind of what the perspective should be. And like you follow my content, but we probably have there's several other people in the organization, depending on the level. There's probably half a dozen people that are fairly active on LinkedIn and a few others that chime in here and there. But it's I try to lead the way in terms of getting people interested in doing it, whatnot. But really, there's a lot of people in the organization that have kind of taken a pretty proactive stance with it. So
do you have like a content KPI at your company? I mean, is it that important to you or is it really just do it in your own time and do it a couple of times a week if you've got time?
I force myself to be active with it every day because it's really part of my role. Everyone else, it's just kind of, it's whenever they have time to do it. So, you know, we encourage people to do it, but the thing is it's fun, you know? And it's like, I think a lot of people have seen like, it's easier to get people to respond to your messages if they've heard of you before, especially like, you know, if you're recruiting in certain circles, you know, you become kind of a more of a known kind of person in that area. So, I'm talking more from like the candidate recruiting side. It's just easier if you're proactively connecting with people on LinkedIn, they can see you're knowledgeable about your area, you're active, and then you actually take the time to talk with them personally. That's kind of the key thing too. If you're making content, but you're one of those kind of people who are just too good to actually interact with everyone, like I talk to anybody, you know, someone asked me a question, like I not just like through my messages, but like I just got off a call today with someone who I just like bullshitting with online, you know? So it's like, you have to be real about it. So.
Yeah. I get quite a few people connecting with me because of the podcast and then asking, you know, if I'd be up for a 15 minute or a 30 minute call. And I pretty much always say yes, because if they're going to take the time to listen to my podcast, I'm going to hear what they have to say as well.
Unless it's an obvious connect and pitch, you know?
You can see them coming a mile off. I mean, that's the hilarious thing about LinkedIn is that you can see all the salespeople coming from miles away. And the funny thing is that they all anoint themselves as like sales coaches and people who can help you do your job better, but they're sending me templated messages out of the box. I mean, when they try to connect with me, they're making no real effort to distinguish themselves by saying, hey, Marcus, you know, what I particularly liked about your LinkedIn profile, or I listened to your podcast with James and it was really funny because of X, Y, and Z. I get very few messages that are personalized still. And I know last time me and you had a chat, we had a very interesting conversation about the fact that you think personalization is overrated. And I think you've got a good point. So I haven't been personalizing my messages quite as much since you told me that. But I still believe in it. But hey, so around the content thing, one of the things that we talked about debunking myths, and I think this is really interesting because the old counter offer myth, when a recruiter tells a candidate, oh, you know, counter offers never work. You know, you'll be out of there within 3 months if you take the counter offer. 90% of people are out of there in 3 months or 6 months. I think that's what you said in your post. But you sort of begun to realize by doing some actual data collection that this was nonsense, right?
Yes. And so here's the thing, because in the process of doing this, a couple of things stuck out. So I'd always heard 90% in 6 months. Other colleagues heard 80% in 12 or whatever. It's always astronomically high, like it never works out and it's a death knell for your career. It's all very things that recruiters would love to be true, but unfortunately aren't. Or should I say fortunately aren't. But the thing is, like, you've been in this industry a while, you start talking to people who've taken counter offers and like it's worked out just fine for them. Like, It's just not feasible that these things can be accurate, you know. And I think that as candidates have become more, as people, like all people, have become more sophisticated, like you don't believe anyone's bullshit sales pitches anymore, right? Just because you see them coming a mile away. It's the same thing with the counteroffer objections. If you're coming at some candidate and telling them, "Oh yeah, there's a 90% chance you're gonna be out of there in 6 months," like. They know that's stupid. Like, why are you still, like, are you the only person who doesn't realize that's bullshit? Because I think everybody else does, you know? So why are you still saying it? So it just drives me crazy because you just have to acknowledge, yeah, it's bad. Counteroffers are bad for recruiters, but they're not bad for candidates. And, like, I think there's always that narrative, whether it's on LinkedIn or the way recruiters talk sometimes, it's always like the companies are out to get you. And they're going to know that you want to leave. Like companies aren't just made of people too, you know? Like, if you've ever managed anyone before, like, if you ever managed anyone before, you know that, like, sometimes you just miss shit, you know what I mean? Like, you didn't know what they're thinking. You didn't know they weren't happy. Like, it's just impossible to think that, like, your manager isn't some omniscient being that knows everything going on in your mind and your life. And if they're not happy in their job, it's your fault for not, like, correcting them. No, they just... And that's the other thing, too, is like sometimes legitimately counter offers are good for both sides because like, yeah, it was a wake up call because their manager like didn't realize they weren't, you know, happy with what they were doing. But now they do because they put their notice in, you know, and then things work out just fine. But, you know, and it goes both ways. It's case. Well, let's get into the data here. So,
yeah, tell me the numbers.
Yeah. So what I did was LinkedIn polls, which. Yes, I think they might be the stupidest thing in the world, but it's because everyone misuses them. And I decided counteroffers are real. It's a very much something that everyone can relate to. And I structured a question. Have you ever taken a counteroffer to stay at your company after resigning? Because I had to specify this is a counteroffer to stay at your company. Otherwise, everybody who's ever like taken a different offer would require. And if so, how much longer did you stay? So yes, left within 6 months. Yes, left within 6 to 24 months. Yes, I stayed 2+ years. No, show me the results. Now, some people were like, why did you put a no, show me the results? Because like, if you don't put a no in there, everyone else will just say, I would leave in this amount of time.
Right, right.
You know? Mm-hmm. So you have to put like, okay, none of these apply to me. So what I did then is obviously you get rid of all those results, anybody who said no, because you only want people who said yes to reply. Those are the only ones that actually matter. So when you kind of scrub the actual data, exactly 30% left within 6 months. 30.8% left within 6 to 24 months, which is admittedly kind of a big gap. And then another 39.2 left in 2+ years. So 40% stayed 2+ years, you know, and I had people arguing with me like, well, if someone left in 1 year, 18 months, isn't that also? I'm like, if the average tenure is 3.5 years, you know what I mean? And you got another year or 2 years out of somebody, like that's kind of a win, right? Like the 90% number is like an outright fraud of a lie. So, but here was the other part that was interesting to me is that does it even matter? Like, does it matter? Like, is tenure a success of happy, is a measure of happiness? No. Like, there are absolutely people who replied to me saying that, like, hey, I left 3 months later, but I'm still glad I took it because I got like a bump in pay and it worked out well for me. Then I went somewhere else. And then I had someone else get back to me saying, I actually stayed a bunch of years and I shouldn't have. It was stupid. Like, I hated that job, you know? So, like, both ways, tenure is absolutely not a measure of, like, was this a good or bad decision? So I did a separate poll. I did another one. If you had taken a counteroffer to stay at your company after resigning, was it a good decision? yes, it worked out well. No, it was a mistake. Undecided, too early to tell. Not applicable. I never took a counteroffer. And it was, I was banking somewhere between 50-50 on the first two options, which are the only two that matter, the 60-40. I was thinking like low end, and I just got it. It ended up being 60% thought it was a mistake, 40% thought it was a good decision.
Does that align at all with what recruiters want to tell candidates, do you think?
No, because like, what's 60-40 really? It's like, I mean, I expect it to be skewed on the side of making a mistake because this is someone leaving their job. You know what I mean? So it wasn't going to be exactly split. It was going to lean that way because, of course, like this is someone who was already on some level unhappy. But, you know, 60-40 is still close enough where it's like it's case by case. There's, you know, there's a lot of times it's going to make sense for you to stay, you know, like slightly more where it doesn't. But like, you can't take this aggregate data and apply it to your personal situation, because this could be a situation where something wasn't aligned, or maybe it was just about money, or, you know, there's a lot of reasons why a counteroffer might make sense to stay. And then there are the boogeyman reasons that recruiters have used ad nauseum over these years.
I've heard recruiters, maybe me, but I've heard recruiters say, look, a counteroffer is basically your employer admitting to you that they've been underpaying you potentially for a very long time. How do you feel about that? Maybe you should get that pay increase backdated 6 months or a year. Then it makes sense. But here's the question on the table. All of these big box recruitment companies actually have pages in their training manual to train their recruiters to prepare their candidates for counteroffers. And I'm sure they're using some of the data that you just mentioned here. How would you advise recruiters now, with access to this new data that you've just gleaned, how would you advise a recruiter to handle that problem? They're about to resign. You've got them a fantastic offer. Everyone's happy. And you're worried that their employer is about to make them a counteroffer. How would you now prepare your candidate to deal with that counteroffer? Or would you just say, it's up to you?
So the reason why I want to go about this is that it just needs to be updated, right? So I think that first you have to, if you're building a proper relationship with the job seeker, you can have these conversations ahead of time to better understand if you think they're a counteroffer risk. You know, you can flat out say like, hey, I'm not gonna be upset if you try to get a counteroffer of your company. Are you gonna do that though? Like, don't leave me hanging high and dry. You know what I mean? Like, you can find out if they're actually open to it. If you have, like, you can have candid conversations with people. You know what I mean? You can also figure out like, if you were the candidate, would you take this counteroffer? You know, because like some of the old school script is based in sound logic. You know what I mean? Like sometimes like this will still be a bad decision. You know what I mean? But if you put yourself in those shoes, like, you know, if you take it, then you need to come up with, you need to deal with the fact that you should have backup candidates already, because you should have been able to see ahead and see this coming. You know, it is your job to have other people. You know what I mean? Because that's literally what you're getting paid for. At the same time, too, like if you can honestly tell yourself this is a stupid decision, like there's no way in hell they should do this, then go back to that old playbook. Like the whole thing didn't suck. You know what I mean? 60% of the time, it is still a mistake. Like, but you can come from a place where you can speak from honest conviction, not just which they can maybe hear resonate a little better in your voice, that you're actually being real with them, not just like the cheesy sales guy telling me everything I need to stay. Because you just have to pick your spots of when it's time to push back because it's the ethical thing to do versus when you're pushing back because you're just being kind of a douchebag.
Yeah. And I think you're right. What you need to do as a recruiter is to maybe just take that relationship to the next level and truly understand whether or not they could be impacted by a counteroffer and sort of empathize with that and talk it through. And then maybe talk about what kind of offer your client needs to make in order to negate them taking that counteroffer, and really understand what the factors are in them taking that job, whether it's all about the money, whether it's a lot of other factors. And then you remind them and have them repeat back to you almost, you know, why do you love the role that we've got you an offer for? And just sort of get it all cemented in there so everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, excellent pickup there. I totally whiffed on the advising my own client to make a better offer. So thanks for picking me up there. That was good.
Yeah, that's okay. That's what I'm here for. So a couple of little previews. That's very interesting stuff on the counteroffer department. And if you go onto James's LinkedIn profile, you'll be able to see all that data and have a look at it for yourself. chance here for a couple of previews. I snuck onto your LinkedIn profile before this conversation, and I noticed tomorrow you're going to be talking about the fact that nobody wants ping pong tables and beer taps anymore. That sounds like it's going to be a fun conversation, yeah?
Yeah, this is what we call a layup. This one does not have a lot of data, but here, not data needed. Yeah, so the thing is, we're just kind of anecdotally realizing that like all the crap that companies used to push, like everything from like office environment. So if we're talking like free lunches and ping pong tables and beer taps, or like even like your gym benefits and your like commute benefits, like all this stuff, like if you're a company in like the employee perks industry, like you have to be getting killed right now because like nobody cares about this stuff. Like all they care about, just I just want more money and I want to work from home whenever I feel like it. That's those are your two levers, and nothing else is really resonating whatsoever from our view. You know, every single like I can't even if you're a recruiter, you can't even pitch honestly. Well, they have a employee stock purchase plan, and you can get your gym membership reimbursed. I'm like, yeah, no, like you're gonna sound like an idiot even trying to say that stuff. So
that's interesting. And look, we haven't really got time for a long conversation about this right now, but towards the end of last year, people were starting to say, I can't wait to get back to the office. But turns out that's not actually the truth, right? I mean, they might want to go back to the office, but I've said this on the podcast before, it's going to get very interesting over the next few months as employers decide whether they're going to force a hybrid model or offer an optional hybrid model. And that's where the recruitment opportunity is going to lie.
Yeah, we've actually done some studies on this internally with our employees and also with some clients and whatnot. And I don't have the numbers in front of me because I was not prepared for this conversation. But overwhelmingly, like most people want the flexibility to come in 2 to 3 days a week. Like there's a small percentage that want to go in all the time. There's a small percentage, but larger still, that want to stay 100% remote. The challenge is though, still the numbers don't tell the whole story, because when you start talking to people more one-on-one anecdotally, it's only under certain conditions. So like my one colleague, he really wants to be in the office 2-3 days a week, probably because he wants to get out of his family life. You know, he's got wife and kids and would love to be back in the office. Problem is, if no one else is there, then he's not interested, right? So he wants to be back 2-3 days a week when everyone else is there, but the rest of his team like wants to be all remote. So it's not as easy as like the numbers. There's a lot of other kind of factors that play into it. I can tell you though that like, I mean, the places that are saying they're going back to 100% remote, we're hearing from their employees. So they're getting in touch with us, like they're going to lose people. And I, like the financial service industry, like that, the bankers and the financial types, because it's such a, they've colluded, you know, Morgan Stanley and Chase and everyone else. But all their other aspects, like all their tech people, their marketing people, their HR, they have options. They don't have to stay in that industry. And like, they're going to start losing people, mark it down.
Yeah, that is definitely where the opportunity for recruiters is going to lie as soon as companies start publishing what their actual policy is going to be. And the final thing, we'll just end up on this. This is another preview. I mean, I'm great at promoting your content.
Oh,
you're about to embark upon a survey to find out what engineers really want in a new role. Okay, that's going to be really interesting, right?
Yeah. So this is the other thing. So this is part three of our series, probably the last part. We did this on salespeople and marketers. And so Nate Guja from Before You Apply, my good buddy, it's the methodology here is real simple. Interviews are basically just gated content for job seekers, right? Like anything, if you're in a room for a job, the stuff you really want to find out, the stuff you ask about like in that second, third interview before you make a decision. If you're a company, why don't you just get those things and advertise that up front? You know what I mean? And that's the entire point of this. So what we were doing is we're offering companies like, here's what your engineering job seekers really want to know about your company before they even apply to your place. Why don't you just like, instead of like gating this to you mail later on, why don't you just lead with this, you know? And there's a survey, it's out there. We're going to run this show next week. So we've got basically a week to kind of collect the data. So we're asking anybody who's in kind of technology or engineering or anywhere else just to, it's three questions, like four kind of qualifying questions, multiple choice, but three questions, in terms of like what you want to hear from recruiters, what do you want to know before you make a decision? What questions you ask in an interview? And I've learned a ton from the first two shows. There's just, you think, you know, people want to know, but you really don't. You know, it's companies companies have such company focused language, like they think they know what's cool about their company they want to sell, but it's not in line with what job seekers actually want to hear about typically. So I think it's pretty impactful. So if it's both of these shows are on YouTube, the what candidates want to know for sales, what candidates want to know for marketing, and then this one will be out there too. But I think you'll learn something if you're trying to hire people in those fields.
Yeah. I mean, as a recruiter, if you could just have access to that information, you could sell that information, because that's what recruiters really want to know. What do engineers really want in a new role? If I can deliver that up in the first conversation with them, I've got a much better chance of generating a submission and potentially a placement. So I would strongly advise all you recruiters out there to jump on James's YouTube channel and check that out too. James, thanks a lot for coming back on the podcast just for a quick chat. We'll have to do this regularly. I'll be watching your content for the rest of the week on the previews that we just talked about. And
Marcus, it's always a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. I'll come back anytime you want. So I have nothing better to do than talk to you.
Thanks, James. Really appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon, mate.
Yep. Later.
Cheers.